I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At a rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania this morning, President George Bush repeated his assertion that Senator John Kerry doesn't know how to fight the war on terror.
The most solemn duty of the American president is to protect the American people. If America shows uncertainty or weakness in this decade, the world will drift toward tragedy. This will not happen on my watch.
John Kerry speaks on the subject of women and the economy in Milwaukee, Wisconsin today, but last night he had this to say.
The world is looking to America to see whether or not we will fulfill our responsibility, not just pick the President of the United States, but to pick a leader of the free world who will bring the world back together and make it safe.
A new Associated Press poll shows the two candidates in a virtual tie. But what about the internals of the poll? Joining us on the line from Washington with a wrap-up of the week behind and a look ahead, Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Richard.
Great to be with you again.
Internals, the specific questions inside the poll. Now, they show that Bush still has a 7-point edge on the question who will better protect the country, although Kerry seems to be closing the gap in both the AP and Pew Research polls on this issue. But is that why we're hearing more about security than, let's say, the domestic issues that John Kerry is said to be stronger on?
Well, both sides are trying to talk about issues where they think they have an advantage, and there's no question that the Bush campaign has based its entire strategy around 9/11, not so much about Iraq, but certainly about 9/11 and terrorism. Of course, we're seeing a lot of pushback from John Kerry. At the same time, he's trying to hit the same another message about the domestic priorities where he thinks he has an advantage, especially on things like healthcare this week.
And so he's also trying to exhibit a strong side. Does that explain John Kerry's goose hunting trip? Dick Cheney called his camouflage outfit the October surprise.
This is all about who is the more macho, and it's also about Ohio. You know, Ohio is obviously a critical battleground. It's also very strong when it comes to hunting and very anti-gun control. I recall one Kerry campaign official telling me that there was a moment when they were going to have Sarah Brady come out and go across the country. They wanted to send her to Ohio, and the Kerry campaign worker said, no, thank you. I love Sarah Brady, but not in Ohio.
Right. And by the way, I blew Dick Cheney's line. He said the outfit was an October disguise, not surprise. Well, this week, televangelist Pat Robertson made a statement that seemed damning of the president. He said President Bush told him that there would be no casualties in the war in Iraq. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about why Pat Robertson would do that. A very loyal ally of this administration, obviously a friend in the White House there. These are very damaging comments for the president, and his advisors have worked very, very hard to basically say Pat Robertson is making this stuff up. It's a very unusual situation where you have the base of the Bush campaign strategy splitting, fragmenting, and going out on TV opposing the president and his account, making him look foolish. Mm. That's very unusual. And again, people are trying to figure out what's going on.
Well, the two campaigns are also exchanging charges over Condoleezza Rice and whether or not she should appear to be campaigning. Cabinet members are supposed to be above that.
They are supposed to be above that, and foreign policy, especially national security advisors, have been out of that game for a very long time. Just to put it into context, Colin Powell has not been doing any campaign speeches, didn't even speak at the Republican convention, even though he'd spoken at previous conventions in 96 and 2000. So she is breaking with tradition. She is politicizing herself and her position. At a time of war on terror, she does expose herself to accusations that she's not concentrating on the war on terror.
And Richard, in the few seconds we have, the candidates' wives seem to have a civilized exchange. You know, Teresa Hines Kerry was accused of saying that Laura Bush never held a job. She went on to say, her words were taken out of context, she said she did different things that will form her. She apologized for the comment, said she forgot that Laura Bush was a librarian and a teacher. Laura Bush said no need to apologize, these are trick questions, but others, including Karen Hughes, the Bush advisor, have really condemned Hines Kerry for this. Are these kinds of exchanges factors?
Well, in a narrow race, everything is a factor, but look, people don't vote for the first ladies or the candidates' wives. What they are trying to have a fight about is women voters in general and how the spouses speak to women voters and their concerns. But to be honest, anyone who really thinks that women voters are going to vote on the basis of one comment or another is smoking something strange, because really what matters are, you know, the traditional bread and butter issues of healthcare, education, that kind of thing.
Richard Wolff, thank you.
Thank you.
Richard is political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Well, an election supervisor in Bay County, Florida, noticed something strange recently. Some potentially fraudulent voter registrations, the one in his son's name, tipped him off. And in Ohio, Mary Poppins and Dick Tracy apparently registered to vote. These are just a few of the election irregularities that election experts are uncovering in the run-up to November 2nd. And voters can report such problems to a hotline set up by a civil rights group. It's called 1-866-OUR-VOTE.
Thank you for calling 1-866-OUR-VOTE, the Election Protection Hotline. You have the right to vote. You're now being transferred to a trained election protection volunteer.
Jonah Goldman is an attorney with the hotline. And Jonah joins us on the line. Jonah, what kinds of problems are you hearing about?
There are a number of problems that are going on. We've had problems with voting machines in Broward County. We had a report that about 9 of 14 electronic voting machines that were supposed to be functioning were not functioning. We've also had a number of absentee ballot problems, from people not receiving absentee ballots to election supervisors actually not being able to get out absentee ballots because of processing problems and lack of actually people to take the calls. We've also had general registration issues. We've had problems with people who have registered at the DMV but have not actually received their voter registration forms. And through follow-up from hotline volunteers, we found out that those people were accidentally actually marked as not wanting to register to vote.
Yeah. How many calls are you getting a day?
It varies somewhere between about 300, I think, is our low end at these days, and 900 is about is the high end.
Yeah. And from certain parts of the country?
Sure. We're getting it from – it is geographically diverse, although we're getting the majority of the calls from – and I think that this comes as no surprise to your listeners – from Florida.
Right.
We're also getting a lot of calls from Texas, which also has, like Florida, a similar early voting structure.
And do you have any way of knowing if your callers are from one party or another?
No, we don't. We don't ask. We don't care. It's not the purpose here is to be completely nonpartisan and just to help voters actually have the opportunity to get to the polls and cast a ballot.
Jonah, thanks.
My pleasure.
Jonah Goldman, staff attorney for the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Well, joining us on the line is Doug Chapin. He's director of electionline.org, which is produced by the nonpartisan Election Reform Information Project. And Doug, I know you're on a cell phone and you're about to board a plane. So first question, how widespread are voting irregularities this year that you see?
I don't think much more than other years. I mean, we're in that portion before the election where machines have been bought and the voter registration list is the only thing that's changing. So it's the only thing left that people have to fight about. And already we're seeing lawsuits in several key battleground states, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, and others, over the issue of provisional balloting. We're also seeing skirmishes in states like New Mexico about voter ID, and again in Florida over the proper role of voting technology.
Well, now these provisional ballots, these are the ones given to voters who show up at the polls but may not appear on the voting lists. The ballots they fill out will be vetted later. But lawyers are fighting over whether those ballots should count if the voter shows up at the wrong polling place. Where do those lawsuits stand?
We've had now five opinions in the last week that come down almost five different ways on that issue about what to do about voters in the wrong precinct, with courts remaining as restrictive as Florida, which is going to uphold the rule requiring voters to be in the right precinct, to courts in Ohio and Michigan overturning those rules and requiring election officials to allow provisional ballots to count if the voter is at least in the right county.
How problematic has voter registration been?
Well, I don't think any more problematic than in past years. The thing to remember is that with the massive interest in the election this year, we're having thousands, if not millions, of new voter registration applications. Right now, then, states are desperately pounding through those millions of new voter applications, trying to get them onto the rolls. And as part of that process, they're finding multiple registrations with similar signatures. We're getting allegations of registration applications being destroyed by partisan registrars. There was a report in today's Washington Post that a Northern Virginia county, Fairfax County, was mailing out voter cards with incorrect information, misspellings, bad addresses, which maybe is much a result of the frantic rush to get people on the rolls as it is any kind of more fraudulent intent.
Right. As we've reported in Nevada, there's actually a lawsuit filed, accusations that partisans tore up Democratic registration forms, and we'll see how that gets resolved. Absentee ballots. We're going to be hearing from a woman in a moment who had a problem with hers. We read that the incoming election supervisor in Florida's Palm Beach County still hasn't received his. How big a problem there?
Right now, there are a couple of factors that are making absentee balloting difficult this year. First, the candidacy of Ralph Nader, the on-again, off-again soap opera of is Mr. Nader on the ballot or isn't he in many states, has held up printing of such ballots and has made it difficult to get them delivered to voters in time for the election. Also, the flux in some states' ability to process their new statewide voter registration databases has made it a trick to determine who's asked for the absentee ballot and who hasn't.
How about poll worker training with all the questions? How's that going?
In various places, some places it's going well. In other places, there's still a dire need for poll workers. My understanding is that the new federal agency, the Election Assistance Commission, has scheduled a conference call for Monday in which they're going to discuss the urgent need for poll workers in many locations. But in even places that have enough poll workers, the fact that they're recruiting them up at the last minute could signal problems in their ability to get those people properly trained in what is now an incredibly complex job.
Right. Voter IDs, what's the problem here?
Well, the Help America Vote Act requires that voters who register by mail and do not provide identification when they register must bring a form of ID to the polls. 17 states have gone beyond that, requiring all voters to show ID, and two states, Pennsylvania and Kansas, require all first-time voters, regardless of how they registered, to show ID. Those rules have sparked controversies in many states, most notably in New Mexico, where Republicans wanted the Democratic Secretary of State to require voters who had registered at community voter drives but did not mail their registrations in by mail to show ID nonetheless. Those challenges were unsuccessful, but New Mexico will be watched closely by lawyers from both parties, and we could see similar problems in other states around the country.
Mm. You know, I'm looking at some of the questions that have been raised across the country. Minnesota, state Republicans were concerned after a man was found with 300 completed voter registration cards in his trunk. Wisconsin has put together a 50-person rapid response team for complaints, and we know both campaigns are sending hundreds of monitors and lawyers are fanning out across the country. How is there concern that all of the concern will lead to perhaps more problems on Election Day with all of these people suddenly in the mix?
Definitely. I mean, people ask me all the time, will there be another Florida in 2004? I think the answer is yes. But not for the reason that most people think. Most people, when they ask the question, are asking, is the system still broken to the extent that we could have breakdowns like we saw in Florida? And there are problems, as we've already discussed. But I think the vast number of people who are out there looking for problems will be a contributor. And in fact, what I tell people is that the vast number of people looking for another Florida actually might help one occur.
Mm. Doug Chapin, director of electionline.org, which is produced by the Nonpartisan Election Reform Information Project, and he needs to get on a plane. Doug, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. And as we heard earlier, absentee ballots can pose problems for election officials and for voters as well. Kathy Julian is an American citizen living in Manila in the Philippines. She registered to vote absentee several months ago. So when she recently received a thick envelope from the state of California, well, let's let her tell you what happened.
You know, when I was opening this up, I opened up the envelope and I thought, now, where is the ballot? And I shook it on the ground, and I was looking, and I thought, now, how could I have lost the ballot? I just opened this envelope. And it's like I looked under my chair, and I thought, oh, brother, how could I have lost this darn thing?
Well, Kathy didn't lose anything. Election officials in Contra Costa County, California, had sent her a voter information guide, a return envelope, and 5 pages of a sample ballot, but no official ballot.
I actually emailed a friend and said, why don't you call the election department, find out what happened? And she did. And she sent me back an email that said the actual ballots didn't come back from the printer until after they had sent me and all the other international voters the information, and so that they instructed us to vote on the sample ballot, put it in an envelope, sign it, and send it back in. Then they said they would then transfer my vote onto a real ballot at the voter registration office.
How did you feel about the suggestion that you should send that in marked?
Well, at first I thought, okay, I'll do that because it makes life simple. I don't have to wait for the real ballot. But then I thought, now who's going to be sitting there when this arrives to transfer my vote onto a real ballot? And I mentioned it to some people at work, and they were amazed. It became very clear to me that something was amiss in this process.
Well, I want to ask you, Kathy, what would your concern be, that you wouldn't trust that your vote be transferred correctly?
I called the department itself, and they explained that I should just vote the sample ballot and send it back in. You know, he sounded very honest on the phone, but it's quite amazing that they would think to do this and not send some information which would perhaps explain if there was going to be a procedure put in place at the voter registrar's office to ensure that there would be transparency and legitimacy in transferring those ballots.
Well, they also, we understand in California, allow overseas citizens to return ballots by fax. What about that option?
I have the same concern there and would prefer to have my ballot be more secret. You know, ultimately, I have, through the courtesy of the U.S. Embassy here, they have sent what is called a federal write-in absentee ballot for general elections, and I did vote in that manner. You fill out a form, you carefully sign your name, you put that secret ballot into an envelope, and then put that into another envelope, and you put it into the mail. So it feels much more secure and safe than what was being proposed by Contra Costa County.
Kathy Julian, a banker who works and lives in Manila in the Philippines, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us.
Okay, thank you.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. We recently spoke with Boston University professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who advocates a consumption tax, a tax on spending. He says this would transfer some of the tax burden from younger wage earners to the elderly who don't pay income taxes. Well, Natalie Hull took issue. She writes, as a professor of elder law at Rutgers University for more than a decade, I can assure you that seniors do pay taxes. Even if retired, they must pay income tax on deferred pension savings paid to them as their pensions. They also pay property taxes, school taxes, municipal utility taxes. On what is usually a fixed income, the tax burden on the retired elderly is often disproportionately higher than on younger, currently employed workers. Well, Sarah Borsting from Medford, Oregon, wrote to confirm our report that Bush protesters were not allowed at Bush rallies. She writes, President Bush visited our humble city in southern Oregon. Anyone who didn't meet with the party standards was escorted out of the rally. One man was asked to leave simply because he had a W sticker over his mouth. Those asked to leave were told that the event was a private party, and if they didn't leave, they would be arrested for disturbing the peace. When Senator Kerry visited a few months ago, it was not a private party. And I think that these two experiences speak volumes for the two candidates' differing views on democracy and party support. Well, we received a lot of mail after yesterday's coverage of the Red Sox pennant win. Many fans convinced they had helped. Tom Gayman said he wears a vintage-style Red Sox baseball cap, but only during these special games so that the energy will not become depleted. Forrest Proper also wrote, my wife Amy discovered during Game 4 that the key to getting the Yankees out was for her to turn her back to the screen and bury her head in a book when they were at bat. We're not superstitious or anything, but why spit in the uncompromising, unforgiving face of fate? That would be stupid. We received one criticism as well from Michael Ellis of Springfield, Pennsylvania. Robin, I can understand the sports writer saying that history was changed when the Red Sox won the seventh game, but words are your business. How could you? You're right. You can't change history. only make it, and the Red Sox did. And finally, after our feature on slang flashcards, which were, by the way, mad crunk, we asked, where'd that word for great come from? Enter Jeff Fear now from Tucson, Arizona. Greetings and sup, dog, he writes. As a 39-year-old white male in West Tucson, Arizona, I feel slightly out of place schooling y'all on slang, but here's the 411. Crunk, derived from crazy drunk, specifically attributed to the Southern hip-hop community as exemplified by early Outkast. Just so as you know, keeping it real. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Keep us real. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. About a year and a half ago, Wissam Abiad chatted online with another gay man and agreed to meet him for lunch in front of a McDonald's restaurant in downtown Cairo. His appointment turned out to be with a vice cop, and Wissam was bundled off to the police station. That was Thursday. By Monday, he'd been tried, convicted, and jailed, convicted of habitual debauchery, although he says it's for being gay. He served 1 year of a 15-month sentence. When he got out, he packed his bags, left Egypt with his American boyfriend, and applied for asylum in the U.S. Last month, he got it. Wissam Abiad joins us from his studio in his new hometown, Springfield, Illinois. Welcome, Wissam.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
And we understand that your partner, Derek Reynolds, is with you as well. Hi, Derek.
Yeah, hi.
And Wissam, I want to start with you first. So take us through the chain of events. You're chatting online.
I was chatting online with a guy who claimed to be Spanish and new in Cairo and wanted to meet new people to show him around the country and show him how to meet other gay people in the city. And when I agreed to meet him for lunch in front of McDonald's that you just mentioned, I found four big people come attacking me and carrying me from each arm and from my pants. And I was carried to the police car. They took my wallet, my passport, my inhaler, because I have asthma, and nobody mentioned anything to me. They didn't even want to tell me where they were taking me until I found later.
I think we have to also explain to people, were you aware, is it commonly known in Egypt that being gay is illegal?
The law doesn't criminalize homosexuality in Egypt. But, like, in my case, they put it under other charges. Like, for my case, they put it under debauchery and provoking litery. Mm.
And the fellow that you were chatting with online obviously turned out to be an undercover cop. Derek, you live there as well. Just fill us in. What is the life of a gay man in Egypt? Is it secretive? Is it, you know, off the radar of most Egyptians?
Right. Well, actually, yes, it's off the radar of most Egyptians. The general population doesn't really know what's happening in most of the subcultures, and a lot of what Middle Eastern culture does is ignore things that you don't necessarily want to notice. You pretend they don't exist.
Right.
And what it was, I lived in Egypt for almost 10 years, and when I first moved to Egypt, there were bars and restaurants and cafes and things where people could go and meet and hang out and socialize in public. And then 3 years ago, when the Queen Boat case, I believe everybody's heard about that maybe.
Remind people, there was a raid of a boat that was also an entertainment area.
Right. 3 years ago in Cairo, in a popular disco, which was in front of the Marriott Hotel in the middle of downtown Cairo, the police raided that disco and arrested a lot of people and ended up charging 52 people with a lot of made-up charges that these people were creating some sort of gay religion and they were creating things that were against Islam and things like this. And the reason why they charged them with those issues is those religious issues are things that people did not want to touch, so people would not really stand up for them and try to protect them. These people were basically all kept together. They were put in the newspapers. Their names and photographs were put on the front page of all of the national newspapers. They were totally humiliated, ended up spending one complete year in prison together.
Well, now, you mentioned that they used religious terms in some of the charges. Is the reasoning religious? Is it moral?
I think one of the things that has led to the problems that are going on currently, which are mostly internet entrapment, is the fear of the infiltration of the West and more open morals and more relaxed Western ideals of what people can do in their lives.
Well, so Wissam, there you are in prison. For how long?
My sentence was 15 months, but I got out after serving 1 year of the 15 months, three quarters of the sentence.
What is prison like for a gay man in Egypt, some would wonder?
Prison is prison. Mm-hmm. I've been to seven different prisons also through this year. I was in the police station. I was always called names. I was verbally abused all the time. Officers would bring their friends or other officers to just watch the gay guy. This is the gay guy we have. They're just, of course, mocking me and making fun of me all the time. And they didn't want to put me in any of the cells because they had a men's cell and women's cells, and they didn't want me to put me in the men's cells because they were afraid I'd be seducing all men in the cell and causing troubles in the jail.
Yeah. So after that experience, you left prison and then applied for asylum in the U.S. What do you think is going to happen to the gay culture in Egypt, Derek? There was a huge cultural shift in the United States that is still in some ways not shifted enough for many Americans, but a huge shift. What do you think is going to happen in Egypt?
That's hard to predict. The world right now, all over the world, seems to be shifting towards a more conservative light with the people in power, which does not bode well for a lot of people. I think, however, one of the things I've worked in technology for a long time, and one of the things that I have heard and learned is that it's very difficult to stop change, and it's very difficult for people, no matter how hard they try, to keep the more liberal and tolerant views of other countries from filtering into their country. So I think over time, and it could be 15, 20 years, maybe even 50 years, I think things in the Middle East will shift so that it's more like in the 50s in the United States.
Wissam Abiad and his partner Derek Reynolds, thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, we're joined now by Wissam's American lawyer, Christopher Nugent, who's part of a special unit of the law firm Holland & Knight that does pro bono work for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender clients. And Chris, explain to us first the history of the U.S. law on asylum as it relates to homosexuality.
Yeah, until 1990, homosexuality was a bar to even entering the United States, not that it was rigorously enforced. The first change came under the first President Bush in 1990, where homosexuality was eliminated as a bar to entry to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And then when did asylum come into the picture?
In 1994, then Attorney General Janet Reno designated an unpublished decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals as precedent involving gay cases. This decision found that homosexuals could constitute a cognizable particular social group for asylum eligibility. So since 1994, there have been approximately several hundred gays and lesbians who have been able to succeed in asylum claims based on their well-founded fear of persecution if deported to their countries.
Well, now, from which countries are they coming?
Virtually from around the world, with the exception of Western Europe and Japan, or Australia or industrialized countries, there have been more claims by gay men than by lesbians, in part, I think, because gay men have been more particularly prone to public forms of persecution by state authorities in their country, whereas the human rights violations of lesbians often have been more private forms of persecution by family members or, you know, in terms of forced marriages and issues like that.
Attorney Christopher Nugent is with the law firm Holland & Knight. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll hear from architect I.M. Pei, now in his 80s. You're listening to Here and Now.
On the ground, a second. And for the first time since 1987, the St. Louis Cardinals are going to the World Series.
So it will be the Boston Red Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals in the World Series after the Cardinals beat the Houston Astros last night to take the National League pennant. Their 16th, a league record. And now the Cardinals are chasing their 10th World Series title, which would be another league record. And people are probably sick of hearing it, but the Red Sox haven't won a series since 1918. Here we go again. Here now is Alex Ashlock, is at Fenway Park here in Boston. And Alex, what are expectations going into this series? Is it going to be a long one, over quickly? What are people saying?
Well, I think people are saying, Robin, that this series could be much like the series that the Red Sox just saw with the Yankees. As you know and everyone knows, that series went seven games. It was a roller coaster ride for Red Sox fans. The Cardinals series with Houston, as we just heard on the clip you just played, that series also went to seven games. So I don't think anyone would be surprised if this St. Louis Cardinals-Boston Red Sox World Series went to seven games, just like the two previous series.
Well, in fact, Cardinals manager Tony La Russa is speaking with some respect of the Red Sox as they head towards Boston. We have a sound from him.
Boston, I think, is, I admire what they went through to, and, you know, we played them in the interleague play last year. A lot of those guys had played three games in Fenway, so we're very familiar with how well and how tough they play.
Yeah, and Alex, Boston Red Sox manager Terry Francona, he's the one you know who rocks in the dugout.
Right.
He sits there and rocks. He also had something to say about expectations. Let's listen.
I mean, I understand the hype and the emotion of, but I thought the emotion was big in the Anaheim series. I actually think the last 2 months of the year, the emotion's been big because it had to be, because we had to play well to keep going.
Yeah. Now, Alex, as you know, there's been a terrible shadow cast over the series here in Boston. Late yesterday, we learned that a college student was killed during post-game celebrations at Fenway, outside of the park where you are. Tell us more about what happened.
Well, Victoria Snowgrove, a 21-year-old student at Emerson College here in Boston, died after she was hit with a pepper spray-filled ball that police had fired into the crowd. This was Wednesday night after the Red Sox had clinched the American League pennant. Thousands of people around Fenway Park, and it got a bit violent, and the police reacted, and Victoria Snowgrove ended up being the victim in that particular instance. I just asked Terry Francona if he had any message to fans regarding this death, and his basic message was that fans should use common sense, and that the Red Sox are trying to bring this city a world championship, and he would like to see fans respect that and respect their fellow fans and use common sense in their celebrating.
Well, as a matter of fact, Mayor Menino, mayor of Boston, has said that he might ban liquor sales during the World Series, and he's asking bars. Well, let's listen to what he has to say.
And also, we're going to put some regulations in place that during the ball games, we ask them not to have any live TV and get the crowds excited. But also, as we discuss all these things we're putting in place, where's the personal responsibility of these students? Don't they have any sense of their responsibility? Why?
Well, you know, Alex, I'm thinking, too, the city has videotapes of the small number of people who were really violent. You can see their faces. Any sense of them arresting any of them in the few seconds we have?
Well, I think that could be the case because, as you know, earlier this year, a Northeastern University student died in the rioting after the Patriots won the Super Bowl. And some of the people involved in that rioting were identified by the use of videotape.
Right. And as you mentioned, some of the Red Sox players themselves have spoken out.
Right. Curt Schilling, the pitcher for the Red Sox, had a message on WROR radio here in Boston today expressing sadness over the death of Victoria Snellgrove. And he said no Red Sox victory is worth such a tragedy.
Right. He also said, grow up.
Right.
To that small handful of fans. Well, we'll see how this unfolds. Alex Ashlock from WBUR and Here and Now. Alex, thanks so much.
You're welcome. It should be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The JFK Library in Boston is celebrating its 25th anniversary. The modernist building was built in 1979 on Columbia Point overlooking Boston Harbor, 16 years after the death of President Kennedy and a decade after it was first proposed. It's hard to imagine now, but residents of Cambridge fought the original plan to build the library there. Cambridge was home to President Kennedy's alma mater, Harvard University, and residents said they didn't want busloads of tourists flocking to Harvard Square. Well, I.M. Pei, a relatively unknown architect back in the 60s, worked with the president's brother Robert and with Jacqueline Kennedy to try to find a site. Recently, Pei sat down with Boston Globe architecture critic Robert Campbell at the Kennedy Library. Here's a portion of their conversation, beginning with Pei's fear that after the community battle and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the library wouldn't get built at all.
When we were off the Columbia Point at that time, next to UMass, we look at it. At that time, you have no idea what this place is. It's a dump. When we excavate it, we find old sinks and old refrigerators and things of that kind. And there were actually methane gas coming out of the soil. You can light a match on it, and then it'll burn. It's that bad. I'm not exaggerating. It's true. So when I look at it, I would say, my gosh, from Harvard, yeah, to this site, it was quite a come down. But we didn't give up. And I know that this is what our president would like to have, so that he can be here and look at South Boston and Boston itself.
You are famous among architects for your interest in geometry and in intersecting geometries. And I wonder, how did you approach the problem as a designer?
Well, geometry is basic to architecture. And especially for a beginning architect, which I was at that time, even today I still stay with it. And I find that it's still, I'm able to do different things out of geometry, or geometric composition.
Do you begin with sketches? Do you begin with models? How does your process work?
I think I had to think about the president, what would he like to be?
Uh-huh.
I think that's number one. And I had, at that time, Jackie with me to think about that, to work with. Actually, she was very active until 68. After that, less so. But she did tell me, say, please, don't put Jack in form of a statue or a bust. I don't want that. I don't think he would like that. So therefore, that's why this pavilion here that you see is empty. There's no statue, no bust, nothing. But more important than space, the space is very simple space, it's really it frames the view of Boston. It's just a flag to say that he was president of the United States. And that's all we did. And Jackie Kennedy accepted that. He said, that's exactly what I want.
You set up a very interesting kind of progression through the building. You come up the driveway, you see the building against the sky, you park, you come across, you come in, you have a view of the pavilion, but you can't get to it. You go down to the right through the movie theaters, and all of the displays and everything, and then you emerge fully into the pavilion. And so you really conceived it as a kind of Stations of the Cross, almost, a kind of set of experiences.
It was that. Mm-hmm. And we did plan it that way.
Are you happy with it?
I think so. I haven't seen it for a long, long time.
It's a modern building.
Mm-hmm.
And JFK wrote to another architect, not you, about a building that he was doing for the federal government. He quoted Pericles. We do not imitate, for we are the example to others. Kennedy wrote to this architect, quoting Pericles. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that? Do you feel that way about the need to do something that is of your own time? That's a very controversial issue now,
course,
as you know.
Of course, I can't say that I succeeded, but I say that we certainly wanted this. Mm-hmm. This is a precast concrete building, mm-hmm. and I would have used stone. Mm-hmm. It's a noble material. I love stone. Probably mm-hmm. know that nearly all of my projects, like National Gallery or the Louvre, we all use stone. I would like stone for this building. It's permanence. And the glass and metal part also could be better, I think. But it's mostly in details. The details are not as important to most people as it is to architects.
I'm going to quote you again. I like simplicity, but at the same time, I don't like monotony. So therefore, the question arises, how can you reconcile the two? How do you reconcile the two?
I've been in practice now almost 50 years. I would say it's just been a problem that I've been dealing with all along. Mm-hmm. I want to combine the two, and it's possible, but it needs a lot of work to get it. And that's why also using geometry. I really use geometry today, even today. I'm not embarrassed about it. I think that's a basic. And if you don't deal with it and do it imaginatively, then I think you fail. As you gradually get into working with more complex geometry, such as Baroque buildings, I think Baroque is a wonderful period in architecture. If you go to northern Germany, to Austria, northern Italy, that part, see those little churches, the pilgrimage churches, they're the best buildings I've seen. And they're all geometrical. And yet, because of the refinement, you know, using curves, which I'm beginning to do, you can then create a wonderful feeling. You see, St. Peter's, when you walk into St. Peter's, you're very, you know, it's just like this, processional. But geometry is just the same, and the feeling is entirely different. Hmm. When you walk through it, space moves.
I'm going to quote two things that have been said negatively about this building, not by me.
Please.
And I'm sure you're familiar with them.
Please.
And I'd like you to comment on them. This first is by John Dixon, who was an editor of Architectural Record magazine. Mm-hmm. The building's forms lack the underlying formal order one expects of a pay work, and the blank surfaces fail at close range to exhibit the refined, eternal-looking qualities for which the firm is noted. The whole architectural experience is one of incomplete gestures, thwarted satisfactions. How do you respond to that?
I think the lack of intricacy on the surface, I mean, the monotony of the surface, came partly because of lack of means. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many things you can do with stone that you cannot do with a building such as this. And if we were able to use stone, then first of all, you get scale.
And you like to use stone that had a kind of varying texture.
Absolutely.
Color.
You have texture. You have color. You have nature coming to help you. Precast cannot be really a noble material. It can never be. But it's the least expensive way to build at that time, only way that we could afford to build. Also, stone, you can have details. It's very difficult to get details into a precast concrete, I think. Then also, I think, on the other hand, I think the spatial sequence that you mentioned earlier, I think that is successful. Mm-hmm. I really have nothing to apologize for that. And also, when you go inside, the part that I like, since somebody's criticizing me, I might as well blow my own horn on it. When you walk into this big glass pavilion and you walk around it, the curvilinear thing in space there is very successful. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a concave
the
curve there.
Fin that comes down,
yeah,
and then,
yeah, and then the
curve.
Concave curve, yeah, comes down. That part is very successful as a space. I like that.
Second negative quote. Carter Wiseman, who wrote a whole book about your work and is a great admirer of yours, as you know. As monument, all the right moves, soaring, gleaming, thrusting. Exterior geometry is too obvious, as if the parts had been ordered from a pay catalog and assembled according to an instruction book.
Partly guilty, but not entirely so. I think Dixon's criticism, I think I would accept. I think that if this building had been built of rich colored stone, it would have been much, much better.
Right. You've been a great audience, great set of questions and comments.
I am Pei, speaking with Boston Globe architecture critic Robert Campbell at the Kennedy Library. Here now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.